readers. Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, as many of you know, a Florida girl. The Sunshine State has been home to, or subject matter for, some of American literature's most important writers. Of course, Ernest Hemingway, Marjorie Kennan Rawlings, Tennessee Williams, even Jack Kerouac called Florida home during their life. But there are so many other greats and rising stars. I felt it was time to give the state its moment in the sun. So settle back in your reach chair, and we'll turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Ernest Hemingway, with second wife Pauline, first heard of Key West from friend John Dos Passos. The couple stopped at the tiny Florida island on their way back from Paris. They soon discovered that life in remote Key West was like living in a foreign country while perched on the southernmost tip of America. Hemingway loved it. Quote, "It's the best place I've ever been, anytime, anywhere. Flowers, tamarind trees, guava trees, coconut palms," end quote. After renting an apartment in a house for several years, the Hemingways bought a large house at 907 Whitehead Street with $12,000 of help from Pauline's wealthy Uncle Gus. If you've been to the Keys, I bet you've toured it. Most folks have made a pilgrimage to the place. To Have and Have Not is Hemingway's only novel set in the United States. Written sporadically between 1935 and 1937, and revised as he traveled back and forth from the Spanish Civil War, the novel is about Key West and Cuba. It's a social commentary on the 1930s, some say, heavily influenced by Marxist ideology that Hem was soaking up from the Spanish Civil War's loyalists. To Have and Have Not is the dramatic story of Harry Morgan, an honest man forced into running contraband between Cuba and Key West as a means of keeping his crumbling family financially afloat. His adventures lead him into the world of the wealthy and dissipated yachtsmen who throng the region and involve him in a strange and unlikely affair. Will Patton narrates.
"I am angry now," he said. "I would like to kill you." "Oh," I told him. "Don't talk so much." "Come on, Pancho," the first one said, then to me. "I'm very sorry. I wish you would take us." "I'm sorry, too, but I can't." The three of them started for the door, and I watched them go. They were good-looking young fellows, wore good clothes. None of them wore hats, and they looked like they had plenty of money. They talked plenty of money, anyway, and they spoke the kind of English Cubans with money speak. Two of them looked like brothers, and the other one, Pancho, was a little taller but the same sort of looking kid. You know, slim, good clothes and shiny hair. I didn't figure he was as mean as he talked. I figured he was plenty nervous. As they turned out of the door to the right, I saw a closed car come across the square toward them. The first thing, a pane of glass went, and the bullet smashed into the row of bottles on the showcase wall to the right. I heard the gun going, and bop, 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 there were bottles smashing all along the wall. I jumped behind the bar on the left side and could see looking over the edge. The car was stopped, and there were two fellows crouched down by it. One had a Thompson gun, and the other had a sawed-off automatic shotgun. The one with the Thompson gun was a... The other had a chauffeur's white duster on. One of the boys was spread out on the sidewalk face down, just outside the big window that was smashed. The other two were behind one of the Tropical beer ice wagons that was stopped in front of the Cunard bar next door. One of the ice wagon horses was down in the harness kicking, and the other was plunging his head off. One of the boys shot from the rear corner of the wagon, and it ricocheted off the sidewalk. The nigger with the Tommy gun got his face almost into the street and gave the back of the wagon a burst from underneath, and sure enough, one came down, falling toward the sidewalk with his head above the curb. He flopped there, putting his hands over his head, and the chauffeur shot at him with a shotgun while the nigger put in a fresh pan, but it was a long shot. You could see the buckshot marks all over the sidewalk like silver splatters. The other fella pulled the one who was hit back by the legs to behind the wagon, and I saw the nigger getting his face down on the paving to give them another burst. Then I saw old Pancho come around the corner of the wagon and step into the lee of the horse that was still up. He stepped clear of the horse, his face white as a dirty sheet, and got the chauffeur with the big Luger he had, holding it in both hands to keep it steady. He shot twice over the head, coming on, and once low. He hit a tire on the car because I saw dust blowing in a spurt on the street as the air came out, and at 10 feet the shot him in the belly with a Tommy gun, with what must have been the last shot in it because I saw him throw it down, and old Pancho sat down hard and went over forwards. He was trying to come up, still holding on to the Luger, only he couldn't get his head up. When the nigger took the shotgun that was lying against the wheel of the car by the chauffeur and blew the side of his head off. I took a quick one out of the first bottle I saw open, and I couldn't tell you yet what it was. The whole thing made me feel pretty bad. I slipped along behind the bar and out through the kitchen and back and all the way out. I went clean around the outside of the square and never even looked over toward the crowd there was coming fast in front of the cafe, and went in through the gate and out onto the dock and got on board. The fellow who had her chartered was on board waiting. I told him what had happened. "Where's Eddie?" this fellow Johnson that had us chartered asked me. I never saw him after the shooting started. "Do you suppose he was hit?" "No. I tell you, the only shots that came in the cafe were into the showcase. That was when the car was coming behind them. That was when they shot the first fella right in front of the window. That came at an angle like this." "You seem awfully sure about it," he said. "I was watching," I told him. Then as I looked up, I saw Eddie coming along the dock looking taller and sloppier than ever. He walked with his joints all slung wrong. There he is. Eddie looked pretty bad. He never looked too good early in the morning, but he looked pretty bad now. "Where were you?" I asked him.
"On the floor."
"Did you see it?" Johnson asked him.
"Don't talk about it, Mr. Johnson," Eddie said to him. "It makes me sick to even think about it."
"You better have a drink," Johnson told him. Then he said to me, "Well, are we going out?"
"That's up to you."
Peter Mathiasen, one interesting man, won the 2008 National Book Award for Shadow Country, a one-volume compilation of three previously released but revised and condensed novels based on the life of Edgar J. Watson, a 19th-century ruthless Florida cane farmer who is said to be a serial killer. Shadow Country includes Killing Mr. Watson from 1990, Lost Man's River from 97, and Bone by Bone in 1999. The book is a substantial revision, reducing the trilogy's 1,300-plus pages to a more easily consumed 900 or so. To quote the author, "There's hardly a sentence in the whole thing that's exactly the same." Mathiasen began writing in the late 50s after a couple of years in Europe, where he was one of the founders of the Paris Review. In early days, he supported himself by working as a commercial fisherman. Next, he began doing what he called hack work for Holiday and Sports Illustrated, and eventually wrote for The New Yorker, where many of his books appeared in serial form. Along the way, he became a Zen monk. Quote, "Zen has been a great help to me in teaching me to simplify my life," he said. "Not that I'm simple yet, just ask my friends." In the late 1970s, he started to think about what would eventually become Shadow Country, imagining it as a modest one-volume novel set in the Florida Everglades and dealing with the oppressions of the blacks and Native Americans there, and the despoiling of the environment. The project would become a trilogy we'll preview now, narrated by Anthony Heald.
3 days before, when that boat had headed south, every last man on the island watched it go, but the postmaster had been the only man to wave. He, too, had prayed that this would be the end of it, that the broad figure at the helm, sinking below the tree line into darkness at the far end of the bay, would disappear forever from the islands. Said D.D. House that day, "He will be back." That old man's Sunday boots descend the Indian mound, then the bare feet of his three sandy, slow-eyed sons. The oldest, Bill House, climbs the steps and enters the store and post office, calling to Smallwood's wife, his sister Mamie. Bill House's feet creak on the pine floor overhead. In the steaming heat, in an onset of malaria, Smallwood feels sickly weak. When his rump emerges from beneath his house and he attempts to stand, he staggers and bangs heavily against the outside wall, causing Mamie to cry out in the room above. He thinks, "This dark day has been coming down forever."
"Look at what come crawling out. Ain't that our postmaster? Keep that spade handy, Uncle Ted. Might going to need it."
Wincing, Smallwood arches his back, takes a dreadful breath, gags, hawks, expels the sweet taste of chicken rot in his mouth and nostrils.
"Got 4 rifles there, I see," he says. "Think that's enough?"
The old man pauses to appraise his son-in-law. Daniel David House is silver-bearded. He wears no collar, but is otherwise dressed formally, in white shirt, shiny black frock coat, black pants, hauled high by galluses. He is crippled. He says,
"Where's his missus?"
"Inside with her young'uns. With your daughter and your grandchildren, Mr. House."
When the elder grunts and turns away, Smallwood's voice pursues him.
"Them women and children gonna have 'em a good view, that what you want?"
Henry Short has stopped behind the house man, holding his rifle down along his leg.
"You too, Henry? You're making a mistake."
"Leave Henry be," said Bill House from the door.
House is 30, a strong, florid man, creased hard by sun. He is followed outside by his sister, who is weeping. Mamie Smallwood cries,
"Shame on you, William House, shame on you, Papa."
The old man turns his back upon his daughter. Lloyd House and young Dan at his heels, he hobbles down the slope toward the water. In a shift of wind, the pot-pot-pot of the oncoming boat comes hard as a pulse. A frantic young woman runs out of the store.
"Oh, dear God!"
She hurries down the steps, calling her little boy. Near the shore, Henry Short leans his old lever-action 30-30 into the split in the big fish-fuddled tree that the hurricane has felled across the clearing. The rifle is hidden when he turns, arms folded tight in a sign that he is here against his will, that none of this is any of his doing. The men are gathering. Charlie T. Bogus, ankle twisted in the hurricane, limps past the store. He turns and shouts back at a woman, calling,
"All right, all right!"
To Smallwood, he complains nervously,
"Ain't you the one said he was gone for good?"
"Not me. I knowed he would be back."
Isaac Yeomans, fiery with drink, acts cheered by what the others dread.
"His kind don't like to be run off. You recall Sam Lewis, Ted, at Lemon City?"
Smallwood nods.
"They lynched Sam Lewis, too."
"This ain't no lynching," Bill House calls.
"Don't think so, Bill. What if he's just coming to pick up his family? Keep on going."
The men stare away toward the south as the oncoming boat comes into view, a dark blur on the pewter water. Most have worn the same clothes since the hurricane. They are rank as dogs and scared and cranky. They are anxious to enlist Ted Smallwood because the participation of the postmaster might afford some dim official sanction. If nobody is innocent, who can be guilty?
"No hanging back,"
shouts old Dan House, glaring at Smallwood.
Russell Banks, the acclaimed author of 17 works of fiction, including Continental Drift and The Sweet Hereafter, splits his year between homes in upstate New York and Florida. While at his Miami home, Russell became aware of a morally complex situation he explores brilliantly in his new novel, Lost Memory of Skin. I'm very excited to have him with us today to speak about his new work. Welcome, Russell. It's such an honor to have you speaking with us today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, okay, I have to ask first thing, The Lost Memory of Skin. Why and how did you choose this title? What does it refer to?
Yeah, it's a good question, I think, because it is a title that doesn't simply name the character. It names a plight, a condition, I guess, a context. And I'm trying to point toward the digitalization of our lives, and especially of our lives where we contact, communicate with, and connect with each other. You know, right at the skin, and I guess it has a lot, therefore, to do with the internet and also with the digitalization of the erotic, and therefore has something to do with the points to pornography and the sense that we're surrounded by it and that it's displaced human sensual and erotic connection. So that's sort of my initial understanding of it, because I had the title well before I got into the book. I was carrying that around in my head it's in my notebook before I even began to write, I see. And actually, I can tell you a little story about how I came to it. I was in France about 4 years ago, and I knew I was going to be working with the story would be dealing with convicted sex offenders living under the causeway and homeless and also people who got there through the internet and pornography and so on. I knew I was going to be dealing with these kinds of really taboo subjects and all. And I was sitting at a little cafe in Paris, and a van went by, and in French it said, Memory of Lost Skin, and it was a soap opera or something in Paris and France at the time. And I thought, that could be a really interesting title, and just flipped the lost around so that it was Lost Memory of Skin. And wrote it down in my notebook, and then later realized I had the title from the start.
Well, I'm going to jump ahead in my list of questions, because there's one thing I did want to ask you. There was one line in the book, kind of early on in the book, and you say, sometimes it's hard to distinguish between love and lifelong dependency. Okay, that really struck me. Is that kind of, you know, philosophy something that you sort of have a concept rolling around in your head and then you find the place for it? Or did a line like that just flow into the story?
Well, I like that. It came out of the story and out of the experience and mentality of the kid. And it's in reference to his relationship to his mother. He's trying to decide, do I really love my mother or do I not? And I knew that's where I was. And so he's reasoning his way toward making a distinction between dependency and love. And his mother, he's troubled because his mother doesn't make that distinction. Because she recognizes he's dependent on her, she thinks that he must love her. And because she's taking care of him in this rather minimal way, she thinks that she loves him. But he's making a more refined and subtle and nuanced distinction between these things and in his way toward understanding what love really is. I know what your question is. I haven't quite answered it. But I didn't carry that around with me as a little maxim or something, or taped it over my computer somewhere. So I find a place to insert it like a raisin into a cake or something. It just grew out of the material itself that I was working with.
Oh, all right. Well,
that's how most of the entire text, you know, pretty. It'll suddenly appear, you know, like a natural and necessary part of the text.
All right. Well, back to the main character, the kid, who is described as a virginal 22-year-old sex offender on parole who lives by necessity in a colony of offenders on the causeway. What drew you to this interest in this story of this real-life situation here in Miami?
The fact that I lived down there 6 months a year over on the South Beach on the Bayside, and my condo is just north of Lincoln Road, and I can look out across the bay and see the Tuttle Causeway. And you know, about 4 years ago, started reading occasional pieces in the Herald about this colony of men, and I was just struck by that. And I could look out and start to wonder what on earth is going on, and what kind of life are these people forced to live, and why, and how, and the fact that, you know, these are the unintended consequences of good intentions, you know, kind of the terrible and sad irony of that struck me. So I would never have, you know, set out to write a novel about that unless I was sort of, it was so proximate to me, it was so close to me. And that's what really drew me to it. And then I started poking my nose around and started doing a little research on sex offending, on the legal ramifications of it, on the psychology of it, from the various degrees and kinds of what we call sex offending. And, you know, it just kind of grew like topsy. And before I knew it, I had a mass of material that I thought, you know, this is really going to make a novel. I mean, there's enough here that we all are, if we're not thinking about it, we probably ought to be thinking about it, because it's facing us, and not just in Miami, but all across the country.
Well, have you seen any progress or hope for change in the way with our society deals with these people?
No, I don't see much. In fact, I'm here in Seattle as we're speaking here, and I just spoke with a man who said here in Washington State they just passed legislation which is designed to keep sex offenders on a permanent parole, as it were, long after they have served their time, paid their debt to society, as it were, and met all the conditions of their conviction, and so on, and which is essentially making a lifetime punishment, making them into lifetime criminals, criminalizing for the rest of their lives. So, in a way, it's worsening, because that kind of legislation is being put forward all across the country in many states, and it does. I don't see that we're beginning yet to think in a more a more subtle and a more realistic way about this, and examining, you know, it both from a legal point of view, but also from a sociological and psychological point of view. Say, what's really going on here now? Not what are we afraid of, but what's really going on, and why are we afraid? Yeah. Looking at it from that point of view. I mean, I'm a novelist too. I'm not a politician or a sociologist or academic, and so my job is really just to raise questions and to provoke those kinds of inquiries, and hope that, you know, in doing that, maybe then change will begin to occur, at least on the edges of things, because it only occurs, you know, really one reader at a time, and that's all I can hope for.
Do you find it more difficult to write about someone who is so flawed, like the kid, not a sex offender, but just truly flawed, versus a character who seems, quote, more normal?
Yeah. Well, I really find it necessary, and finally, in the end, I suppose, easier for me, in as much as I don't, I'm following my instincts, to write about people who are very different from me, who are mysterious to me, and at least at the beginning, unknowable, and to me personally, and so that's been the habit of mind and the nature of my imagination since I was a very young writer. Is I'm not interested in writing about myself or even about people like me. I'm really interested in trying to understand people who are different from me. Mm. So I've written about, you know, Africans and Haitians and women and poor people without any privilege that I have or power that I carry around. People who most of us tend to ignore, or who are invisible or unheard in our daily lives. And so, but the reason being is not that I'm on a mission or that I have an ideology about that. It's just that they're mysterious to me. They're unknown to me. And the only way I can begin to understand them is by getting close to them through the process of fiction, through telling stories and looking at the world through their eyes, in a sense, inhabiting these characters.
Well, the other key character in the book is the professor, described as a man of enormous size and intellect. How did you decide to wrap the story about these two very different kinds of men?
Yeah, well, the professor appears in the story because I needed to have kind of an outsider's point of view. I couldn't tell the story entirely from the kid's point of view without it becoming, frankly, the kid's incapable of telling his own story. That's one of the points of the narrative, is that certainly in the beginning he doesn't have a narrative of his own. He can't link the various events of his life together into a coherent story. I needed a character who could come in and evoke that from him, and the professor with his tape recorder and film and camera, who is studying homeless convicted sex offenders and the relationship between homelessness and the convicted sex offending. I just needed him on a strategic level. And then when I brought him in, I thought, well, there are various kinds of addictions. The kid may be addicted to pornography, or he's addicted to the internet. Well, you know, it's not unlike someone who's addicted to food, who's, you know, weighs a quarter ton, and when he opens his refrigerator, the parts of his brain that go off and light up are the same as the parts in the kid's brain that go off and light up when he clicks his way onto a porn site.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I know you're on a very, very busy book tour, but are you already working on your next project?
I know what I'm doing next, and I've got my eye on it. And I get through with this book tour at the end of October. I'm going to settle down with my wife and my two dogs over there in South Beach and go to work and not come out and not talk to anybody until I get it done.
Russell, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy, busy schedule to speak with us today. The book is really powerful.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks. Bye. Suspended in a strange modern-day version of limbo, Kid, the young man at the center of the story, is on probation as a convicted sex offender and shackled to a GPS monitoring device. The kid is forbidden to live within 2,500 feet of anywhere children might gather, so you do the math. With nowhere else to go, the kid takes up residence under a South Florida causeway in a makeshift encampment with other convicted sex offenders. Barely beyond childhood himself, the kid, despite his crime, is in many ways an innocent, trapped by foolish choices he struggles to comprehend. Enter the professor, a man who's built his life on secrets and lies. A university sociologist of enormous size and intellect, he finds the kid the perfect subject for his research. The two men forge a tentative partnership, the kid remaining wary of the professor's motives, even as he accepts the counsel and financial assistance of the older man. When the Causeway Camp is first raided by the police and later decimated by a hurricane, the professor tries to help the kid in practical matters. But when the professor's past resurfaces and threatens to destroy his carefully constructed world, the balance in the two men's relationship shifts. Suddenly, the kid must reconsider everything he's come to believe and choose what course of action to take when faced with a new kind of moral decision. Lost Memory of Skin probes our troubled society where zero tolerance has erased any hope of compassion, a society where isolating the offender has perhaps created a new kind of victim. The title is narrated by Scott Shepherd.
He's shivering because he's afraid of the answer to the question that drove him here, even though he already knows it. Listen, can I ask you something? It's kind of personal, I guess.
Of course.
Well, see, I live out in the North End, and the people in my neighborhood, my neighbors, they're all, like, telling me that there might be, like, a convicted sex offender living there in the neighborhood. And they tell me that you could just go online to this site that tells you where he's living and all, and they ask me if I'd check it out for them, for the neighborhood. Is it true?
Is what true?
You know, that you can just, like, go online and it'll tell you where the sex offender lives, even if you don't know his name or anything.
Well, let's go see,
she says, like he asked her what's the capital of Vermont, and leads the kid across the room to a long table where six computers are lined up side by side and no one is using them. She sits down in front of one and does a quick Google search under convicted sex offenders, and up pops the National Sex Offender Registry, which links straight to www.familywatchdog.us. The kid stands at a forward tilt behind her, shifting his weight from one foot to the other. He thinks he should run now. Get out of here fast before she clicks again, but something he can't resist, something he knows is coming that is both scary and familiar, keeps him staring over the librarian's shoulder at the screen the same way he used to get held to the screen when cruising pornography sites. The librarian clicks Find Offenders, and then on the new menu hits By Location, and another menu jumps up and asks for the address. You're from Colusa, right? What's your neighborhood zip code? It's, 33135. Any particular street you want to look up? He gives her the name of the street where his mother lives and he used to live, and she types it in and hits search. A pale green map of his street and the surrounding 20 or so blocks appears on the screen. Small red, green, and orange squares are scattered across the neighborhood like bits of confetti. Any particular block? The kid reaches down to the screen and touches the map on the block where he lived his entire life until he enlisted in the army, and where he lived again after he was discharged. A red piece of confetti covers his mother's bungalow and the backyard where he pitched his tent and built Iggy the Iguana's outdoor cage. The librarian clicks onto the tiny square, and suddenly the kid is looking at his mugshot, his forlorn, bewildered face. And he feels all over again the shame and humiliation of the night he was booked. There's his full name, first, last, and middle. Date of birth, height, weight, his race, color of his eyes and hair, and the details of his crime and conviction. Slowly, the librarian turns in her chair and looks up at the kid's real face, then back at the computerized version. That's you, isn't it? I gotta go, he whispers. I gotta leave. He backs away from the woman, who appears both stunned and saddened, but not at all afraid, which surprises him. And for a few seconds, he considers trying to explain how his face and his description and criminal record got there on the computer screen. But there's no way he can explain it to someone like her, a normal person, a lady reference librarian who helps people look up the whereabouts and crimes of people like him. Wait, don't leave. I gotta go, I'm sorry. No kidding, I'm really sorry. Don't be sorry. No, I'm probably not even supposed to be here, he says. In the library, I mean. He turns and walks stiff-legged away, and then as he nears the door, he breaks into a run, and the kid doesn't stop running until he's back up on his bike, heading for the causeway. Like everyone over a certain age, the kid has a name, naturally, but none of his neighbors under the causeway knows it, and he has no intention of giving it out, unless the alternative is getting beat up or cut by one of the more occasionally violent wingnuts living down there.
Tananarive Due was a journalist at the Miami Herald during my early years there. She's now a best-selling author and an American Book Award winner. A departure from her fiction, Freedom in the Family, a mother-daughter memoir of the fight for civil rights, Due and her mother, Patricia Stevens Due, guides listeners through the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Told in alternating chapters, their story is a triumphant memoir of their experiences with everyday people fighting for equality as members of grassroots organizations in the South. Freedom in the Family inspires and enlightens with its riveting account of one of America's most progressive times. Patricia Floyd narrates.
The American Negro must remake his past in order to make his future. Arthur A. Schomburg. There are so many misconceptions today about the civil rights movement. People think blacks were a unified front in the old days, with everyone marching and holding hands. Well, that's not true. If only it had been that easy. Just like today, in cities and towns across the South, there were always a select few who lit the fires and went to the meetings, and eventually others followed. Dr. Martin Luther King wasn't the only one lighting the fires. He had a lot of influence, but he was only one man. It concerns me when I hear people say, if only we had Martin Luther King today, as if we're helpless without him. I wish we had Dr. King today, too, but Dr. King did not create the movement. There were hundreds and thousands of ordinary people who did extraordinary things. Daily heroism went unrewarded and unrecorded. Some heroes were children, and some were retired. There were maids, ministers, students, teachers, housewives, and they suffered. Their families suffered. Their jobs suffered. I know people who never recovered from the movement. I know people who today cannot bring themselves to talk about what happened to them during that era. I know people who had to spend time in mental institutions. I knew people who committed suicide. I knew people who died. And they were all ordinary people. I remember sitting on a textbook committee for school children in Miami-Dade County a few years ago. And when I asked why the social studies books under consideration mentioned nothing about Tallahassee's civil rights struggle, school officials tried to tell me that nothing of note had happened in Florida. I was there, I protested. But they looked at me as if I were speaking a foreign language. A living witness didn't matter to them. Without written documentation, I was told, the 49 days my sister and I spent in jail, the tear gas that burned my eyes, and the people I knew could not be included. As if we had never existed. There's a saying I believe in. History belongs to those who write it. I have to write ours.
Another Miami Herald alumni, journalist Edna Buchanan, has been dubbed the Queen of Crime by the Los Angeles Times. Edna Buchanan has covered more crime than most cops. She's won a Pulitzer Prize for her news reporting. For more than two decades, she's wowed critics and fans with her sizzling thrillers. And there's a new one coming out next month, A Dark and Lonely Place. To get you ready, we'll preview her classic, Legally Dead. U.S. Marshal Michael Venturi of the Witness Protection Program relocates a monster, now a government witness, to a small town after creating a new identity for him. The man proves to be a monster unleashed on an unsuspecting community. The results are tragic. To make amends, Venturi leaves the Marshal Service and assembles a team of close confidants to secretly create new identities for innocent men and women whose lives have been ruined through no fault of their own. But before they are relocated and reborn, each must change a lifetime of habits and actually become someone else with new traits, tastes, and personalities. And before being declared legally dead, they have to die. In these deaths, phony forensics must be created to fit the facts and fool the experts. Venturi's fascinating experiment works for a time. But as he continues to relocate the deserving, evil begins to stalk Venturi and his legally dead clients. Soon one is dead, and Venturi's own loved ones are now targets. In a desperate race to protect those he has relocated, Venturi must call upon his former training in both the Marines and the Marshal Service as he's hunted by police, prosecutors, ruthless killers, and his former federal colleagues. Mark Deakins narrates.
Fresh air and exercise would keep him too busy for unhealthy obsessions. But soon her house became a major landmark on his route. She lived on the far side of a small park surrounding an imposing stone sculpture, a horseman wielding a raised sword. He paused to read the plaque at its base. The inscription identified the writer. He was General John Stark, who led the New Hampshire Minutemen to battle in the Revolutionary War and coined the state's motto, "Live free or die." He studied the horseman's face and his sword, then checked his watch and quickly moved on. His walks were synchronized with her schedule, so he could see what she wore and didn't. How much more smooth, milky skin would she bear as the long, dreary days of winter began to yield to blindingly bright yellow daffodils? Unlike the stone-faced general, she exuded life and energy. He obsessed over the impatient jut of her hip, her merry laughter, and the graceful curve of her neck, exposed when she pinned her glowing hair back. They all fueled his fantasies. Spontaneous and typically female, she was not always predictable, or inclement weather would intervene. Often he was disappointed, but when she was on her front porch, in the driveway, or in her yard, it was worth the wait. Eventually, she began to acknowledge him with a look of recognition, then a smile, and most recently, a friendly wave. He responded with a neighborly nod, nothing more. He had been told to make friends. How do you do that in middle age, when all your previous friendships were forged and flourished in childhood? Friends grow up together, cover each other's backs, and build alliances through a lifetime of history shared back in the day. An outsider here, he was as disoriented as an alien from a distant planet. He and his new neighbors shared nothing in common. Many seemed short on teeth, but still spoke in uppity tones. The women appalled him. Where did they grow, these heifers? Yet the gaggles of runny-nosed kids who trailed behind them were proof that men actually slept with them. Disgusting. So he kept to himself, kept control, held his demons at bay. He did wrestle with the devil on occasion. He emerged from the exercise room at the community center one sunny afternoon, sweaty and exhausted, and she was there at the pool, hair wet, skin glistening, a thirsty towel draped around her neck. She giggled with a friend, hunched her slim shoulders, and hugged her arms against a chilly breeze. Teeth chattering, she turned away. He licked his lips and swallowed, close enough to see the goose flesh rise on the inside of her pale thighs and how the clingy fabric of her wet bikini bottom rode up her. He positioned his exercise bag in front of him to conceal his excitement, catching his breath at the sight of her daintily extended bare leg as she slid gracefully into the car for the ride home. The moment was defining. She saw him watching, he thought, and flaunted herself. Deliberately. Tried to turn him on and succeeded. Females are born knowing how to drive a man crazy. Still, he never would have touched her, but destiny intervened. Late one afternoon, as he nodded off in his underwear and socks watching a Yankees game taped over the weekend, the doorbell launched him to his feet, totally awake. Instinctively, he dove for the small silver-colored automatic pistol concealed beneath a sofa cushion. He pressed his thick back to the wall and released the safety. There was a growing chill outside the window and the feel of rain in the air. The streetlights were still dark. Cautiously, from behind the curtains, he squinted into the deepening dusk.
Randy Wayne White is a journalist, veteran fishing guide, and an author of several nonfiction collections. He also creates superb, best-selling suspense fiction. His novels have received high praise from all around the country, including authors like Carl Hyacin, who says, "Randy Wayne White takes us places that no other Florida mystery writer could hope to find." In Night Vision, Doc Ford is on a collision course with death. A lot is going on in a trailer park known as Little Guadalajara, inhabited principally by illegal laborers. The park manager is the hired gun of a financial syndicate that wants to develop the property, and the guy's prepared to do whatever it takes. But he just can't figure out what to do about one teenage girl, the one the laborers believe has some sort of gift. When the girl witnesses a murder, her only hope for survival is Doc Ford. What a page-turner, performed by George Guidall. Let's listen.
I thought, oh boy, here we go. But I pressed ahead, saying, "Tola just turned 13, you told me. Her mother's first name is something unpronounceable, so she goes by Mary or Maria. Tola arrived in Florida about 8 days ago, and you met her. You said you met her by coincidence at a trailer park the owners are trying to condemn so they can build condos. She lives with five other people in a single wide. Meeting her wasn't coincidental. I would never say coincidental because I don't believe in... I interrupted again. But you didn't tell me the whole truth, did you? You didn't say that about once a month you cruise the immigrant neighborhoods buying grass or fresh peyote buttons. The illegals smuggle in peyote from Mexico because it's safer than carrying cash they probably don't have in the first place. You used to drive your VW, but lately you've been taking your electric bike. What, you think it makes what you're doing less obvious? Just the opposite, pal. I waited, glancing at the rearview mirror until I saw the man's smile of concession, before he added, "See, I was listening." Tomlinson disappeared into his own brain as I drove west, his right hand still surfing the wind, his left fist cupping a can of Modelo. Disappeared is a fitting description. Tomlinson has spent so many nights alone, at sea, he says, that he has constructed the equivalent of cerebral theme parks in his head for entertainment. Books, religion, music, whole communal villages populated, presumably, with Jimi Hendrix and Hunter S. Thompson types. All probably landscaped with cannabis sculptures trimmed to resemble objects and creatures that I preferred not to imagine. Tomlinson is a strange one, but a good one. His perception of reality has, over the years, been so consistently tinted by chemicals that my guess is he has reshaped reality into his own likeness. And it's probably a kinder, brighter reality than the one in which most of us function. Tomlinson is among the most decent men I know, if you don't count sexual misconduct, which I am trying to learn not to do. He's brilliant and original, something I can say only about a handful of people, and I count him among my most trusted friends. Again, his behavior with women excluded. He had come into my little marine lab earlier that day asking for help, and when a friend asks for help, you say yes and save the questions for later. It was later, almost 10 p.m., according to the chronofighter dive watch on my left wrist. March is peak tourist season in southwest Florida, so beach traffic was heavy, both lanes a bumper car jumble of out-of-state license plates punctuated by roaring packs of Harleys. After several minutes of silence, Tomlinson's attention swooped back into the cab of my truck, and he said, "This place we're going on San Carlos Island, the trailer park's named Red Citrus, and it's not far from the shrimp docks, and lately it's become a bitch of a dark space, man. I should have warned you before we started." I said, "The shrimp docks? That sounds close to your new restaurant." Tomlinson, the hippie entrepreneur, had opened a rum bar and grill on Sanibel, and another at Fisherman's Wharf near the shrimp yards, Bayside, Fort Myers Beach. I was one of the investors, as was my cousin Ransom, who also managed both places along with her two boyfriends, Reno Bentley, a Cajun, and Big Dan Howes.
And speaking of Carl Hyacin, most readers agree no one gets the wackiness of the state better than Carl. Carl has been at the Miami Herald since 1976, initially focusing on property development and the construction industry, exposing schemes to despoil the natural beauty of Florida for profit. He began writing a regular column in 1985, based on his belief that, and I quote, "The Sunshine State is a paradise of scandals, teeming with drifters, deadbeats, and misfits, drawn here by some dark primordial calling like demented trout. And you'd be surprised how many of them decide to run for public office," end quote. Hyacin's Florida is a banana republic of greedy businessmen, corrupt politicians, dumb blondes, apathetic retirees, intellectually challenged tourists, and hard luck rednecks. In Nature Girl, Honey Santana is determined to set up her own tour business, paddling tourists around the Florida Everglades in ocean kayaks. The result is one disastrous kayak trip, a misadventure on Dismal Key, and a cast of characters as colorful as a Florida sunset. William Roberts narrates.
On the second day of January, windswept and bright, a half-blood Seminole named Sammy Tigertail dumped a dead body in the Lost Man's River. The water temperature was 59 degrees, too nippy for sharks or alligators, but maybe not for crabs, thought Sammy Tigertail. Watching the corpse sink, he pondered the foolishness of white men. This one had called himself Wilson when he arrived on the Big Cypress Reservation, reeking of alcohol and demanding an airboat ride. He spoke of ringing in the New Year at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino, which was owned by the Seminole tribe on 86 acres between Miami and Fort Lauderdale. Wilson told Sammy Tigertail that he'd been sorely disappointed not to find a single Indian at the casino, and that after a full night of drinking, hot babes, and seven-card stud, he'd driven all the way out to Big Cypress just to get himself photographed with a genuine Seminole. "Some dumb bet me $100 I couldn't find one," Wilson said, slinging a flabby arm around Sammy Tigertail. "But here you are, brother. Hey, where can I buy one of them cardboard cameras?" Sammy Tigertail directed Wilson toward a convenience store. The man returned with a throwaway Kodak, a bag of beef jerky, and a six-pack. Mercifully, the airboat engine was so loud that it drowned out most of Wilson's life story. Sammy Tigertail heard enough to learn that the man was from the greater Milwaukee area, and that for a living he sold trolling motors to walleye fishermen. 10 minutes into the ride, Wilson's cheeks turned pink from the chill, and his bloodshot eyes started leaking, and his shoulders hunched with the shakes. Sammy Tigertail stopped the airboat and offered him hot coffee from a thermos.
How about that picture you promised? Wilson asked.
Sammy Tigertail patiently stood beside him as the man extended one arm, aiming the camera back at them. Sammy Tigertail was wearing a fleece zip-up from Patagonia, a woolen navy watch cap from L.L. Bean, and heavy khakis from Eddie Bauer, none of which would be considered traditional Seminole garb. Wilson asked Sammy Tigertail if he had one of those brightly beaded jackets and maybe a pair of deerskin moccasins. The Indian said no. Wilson instructed him not to smile and snapped a couple of pictures. Afterwards, Sammy Tigertail cranked up the airboat and set out to finish the swamp tour at the highest possible speed. Because of the cold weather, there was practically no wildlife to be observed. But Wilson didn't seem to mind. He'd gotten what he came for. Squinting against the wind, he gnawed a stick of dried beef and sipped on a warm Heineken.
Leonard is the author of more than 40 novels. Known for his crackling dialogue and dark humor, his most famous book is perhaps Get Shorty, the tale of a small-time Florida hood who goes to Hollywood to break a few thumbs and stays to break into the movies. Leonard had a career in advertising when he began writing westerns early in the 1950s. He had a major hit in 1961 with his novel Hombre, which was turned into a blockbuster starring Paul Newman. He began adding fast-paced modern crime stories to the mix with heroes who were just out of or maybe headed back to jail. Leonard's stories often feature the misadventures of those amiable but crooked protagonists, along with lowlifes, thieves, hustlers, bail bondsmen, and loan sharks. His novel Road Dogs tells the tale of Jack Foley serving a 30-year sentence in a Miami penitentiary. But Jack has made an unlikely friend on the inside. Fellow inmate Kondo Ray, an extremely wealthy Cuban criminal, arranges for Foley's sentence to be reduced from 30 years to 3 months. When Jack is released just 2 weeks ahead of Kondo, he agrees to wait for him in Venice Beach, California. Also waiting for Kondo is his common life wife, Dawn Navarro, a professional psychic with a slightly ulterior motive for staying with Kondo. Yep, she wants his money. And with the arrival of Jack, she sees the perfect partner in a plan to relieve Kondo of his fortune. Kondo may be Jack's friend, but does that mean he can trust him? Can either of them trust Dawn? You can trust you'll enjoy Leonard at his best. Peter Francis James narrates.
Later on, when they were outside, the Cuban stopped Foley.
You call me a greaseball to my face?
This little bit of a guy acting tough. Where you been? Foley said. You get stuck with the white power ding-dongs, the best thing is to sound as dumb as they are, and they'll think you're funny. You heard them laugh, didn't you? And they don't laugh much. It's against their code of behavior. This was how Foley and Kundo hooked up at Glades. Kundo said Foley was the only white guy in the joint he could talk to. Foley, a name among all the grunge here, and knew how to jail. Stay out of other people's business. Kundo's favorite part of the day was walking the yard with Foley, a couple of road dogs in tailored prison blues, and tell stories about himself. How he went to prison in Cuba for shooting a Russian guy, took his suitcase and sold his clothes, his shoes, all of it way too big for him. Came here during the time of the boat lift from Marielle, 27 years ago, man, when Fidel opened the prisons and sent all the bad dudes to La Yuma, what he called the United States, for their vacation. How he got into different hustles, didn't care for armed robbery, liked boosting cars at night off a dealer's lot. He danced go-go in gay bars as the Cat Prince, wore a leopard print jockstrap, cat whiskers painted on his face, but scored way bigger tips ladies' night at clubs, the ladies stuffing his jock with bills.
Here is this middle-aged mama with big tetas. She say to me, come to my house Saturday. My husband is all day at his golf club. She say to me, I give you 10 $100 bills and eat you alive.
Man, and how he was shot 3 times from his chest to his belly and came so close to dying he saw the dazzle of gold light you hear about when you're approaching heaven, right there. But the emergency guys see he's still breathing, blood coming out of his mouth, his heart still working, man, and they deliver him alive to Jackson Memorial, where he was in a coma 34 days, woke up, and faked it a few more days, listening to Latina voices, the nurse helpers talking about him. He learned he was missing 5 inches of his colon, but healed, sewed up, good as new. When he opened his eyes, he noticed the mozo mopping the floor wore a tattoo on his hand, an eye drawn at the base of his thumb and index finger, a kind of eye he remembered from Combinado del Este, the prison by Havana. He said to the mozo,
we both Mariolitos, huh? Get me out of here, my brother, and I make you rich.
Foley said, you thought you'd be cuffed to the bed.
Maybe I was at first, I don't know. I was into some shit at the time. Didn't work out.
A cop shot you?
No, it was a guy, a picture taker in South Beach, before it became the famous South Beach. Before that, he was a Secret Service guy, but quit to take pictures. One he did. A guy being thrown off I-95 from the overpass, man, down to the street, the guy in the air. Joe La Brava sold to a magazine and became famous.
Why'd he shoot you?
Man, I was gonna shoot him. I know him, he's a good guy, but I was not going to prison for a deal this woman talked me into doing with this dumbbell hillbilly rent-a-cop. I didn't tell you about it. I pull a gun, and this guy who used to be in the Secret Service beats me to the draw. Puts 3 bullets in me, right here, man, like buttons. I should be dead.
Kundo grinning now.
But here I am, huh? I'm in good shape. I weigh the same now as the day I left Cuba. Try to guess how much.
He was about 5'4", not yet 50, but close to it. His dyed hair always slicked back in a ponytail. 130, Foley said.
128. You know how I keep my weight? I don't eat that macaroni and cheese they give us. I always watch what I eat. Even when I was in Hollywood, going out every night is where I went when the mozo got me out of the hospital to L.A., man. See a friend of mine. You understand? This was the time of cocaine out there. All I had to do was hook up with a guy I know from Miami. Soon I'm taking care of cool dudes in the picture business, actors, directors. I was like them. I partied with them. I was famous out there.
Foley said, till you got busted.
There was a snitch. Always. Even in Hollywood.
Readers, I hope you've enjoyed today's exploration of Florida. Trust me, we haven't even scratched the surface of books inspired by the state. And when you're looking for inspiration on what to read next, make sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. You'll find a great mix of the new and the notables, and the classics you may want to discover for the first time or return to. And please return in 1 week for our next literary journey together on The Book Report.